This is Continental Media 0603. Continental Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave, and is a supplement to our other program produced more often, World of Radio. Furthermore, this edition of COM will later be released as World of Radio Extra 66. Continental Media is made possible by Universal Radio. Check their website, www.universal-radio.com, or call toll-free for a catalog, 1-800-431-3939. Universal also sponsors the most useful site, www.dxing.com, Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. More frequencies you can kiss goodbye, says Al Qualieri in forwarding an FCC public notice. Report number 388 on experimental actions, released March 30th, 2006. These are new stations which have been authorized for ocean radar, also known as CODAR, those swishing sounds we already hear in various places on the shortwave bands, but more of them are to come at numerous locations in the U.S. Although there are two stations licensed, each one of them has a number of different transmitter sites and frequencies. I'm going to read all the details because I think they're of considerable interest. The first one has a call sign, WD2XVR, X-ray Victor Romeo. It's for the University of or College of Marine Sciences in South Florida. It's experimental, as the X implies, to operate on these frequencies, 4470, 4550, 4800, and 4900 kilohertz. It says to use a coastal ocean radar system to measure near-shore surface currents. Well, we already hear some in these areas. Now I guess there will be more. The locations, along with the county, are given. These are fixed locations. Naples in Collier County, Reddington Shores in Pinellas, Cedar Key in Levy County, Holiday in Pasco, and Siesta Key in Sarasota County, all in Florida. Now, the other ones are in California. WD2XVS, X-ray Victor Sierra, for San Francisco State University at the Romberg Tiburon Center. These are to be on megahertz frequencies, given as 12.06, 12.14, 12.2, 13.46, 13.63, and 13.7 megahertz for CODAR ocean surface current monitoring. Once again, we have the locations and the California counties. Drake's Beach and Marin County, Big Sur, Monterey, Pacific Grove, Monterey, 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 Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz, Davenport in Santa Cruz, Pescadero in San Mateo, Montara in San Mateo, Sausalito in Marin, Bolinas in Marin, and San Francisco, San Francisco, plus Carmel in Monterey County. Thanks again to Al Qualieri in New York for forwarding this information. Here's an interesting narrative which appeared in National Radio Club DX News via Bill Hale. It's written by Dave Normant in Hagerstown, Maryland, titled The WHGT 1590 Transmitter Chase. Several weeks ago, my good friend Gerald Conkling and I set out for Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, in search of the WHGT 1590 transmitter site. We both had been reading bits and pieces about WHGT, and curiosity was getting the best of us. Chambersburg is only a matter of miles from my home in Hagerstown, Maryland, so it was a very short drive up there. As we drove up I-81 northbound, we detected a signal on 1590 as we approached the downtown Chambersburg exit. It was extremely weak. I'd been scouting 1590 out for weeks from my home, and I was never able to copy the station I'd been reading so much about. Chambersburg is only 15 miles north of me, so whatever the facility might be, we determined it had to be super low power. Being able to hear it near the downtown exit only proved our suspicions correct. We initially thought it might be on the WCHA tower, which is to the west of downtown Chambersburg on State Route 30. We drove out in that direction and noticed the signal was increasing in strength, but by the time we reached the WCHA site, the signal had dropped. We then went east on 30 back into town and continued east towards I-81 and noticed the signal increased and then severely dropped by the time we hit the I-81 interchange. We then doubled back towards the west until we hit Route 11. We went south on 11 and noticed the signal increased where Route 30 and 11 met. But when we took Route 11 south, the signal faded rapidly. We turned around and headed north on Route 11, and the signal increased to near peak at Route 11 and Route 30. We continued north on 11 and noticed the signal was fading fast, so the obvious assumption was the site had to be near the intersection of Routes 11 and 30. We took a left on 30, heading west. It was getting dark, but hopes were still high for finding the transmitter. As we drove around the neighborhood in the area of Route 30 and 11, I noticed a church way up on top of a hill and commented to Jerry that I bet it's up there. The format is satellite-fed Christian music and preaching, with no local breaks or commercials. We were lucky to catch an inserted top-of-the-hour ID that said nothing more than the call letters WHGT. The signal was extremely weak, no matter how close we thought we were to the transmitter, with very little to no splatter on either side of the carrier. The audio was poor. The whole ball of wax was smelling very much like a talking house transmitter. We turned on Grandview Avenue, then left on Miller Street in downtown Chambersburg and up the driveway to the church, which is called the Open Door Church. The property is large and vast, with a Christian school on the premises. We were driving around their property in the dark of night, looking here and there for any signs of an antenna, when we were approached by someone in a van. Windows were wound down, and I spoke first, trying to answer the questions that were obviously going to be asked before the guy in the van even asked them. It turned out the gentleman was a deacon at the church, who informed us that the transmitter was located within the Christian school at the top of the hill. Even before the deacon appeared, Jerry and I conducted a little test on the church property. Since neither of us had a portable radio, we were relying on my Pontiac Grand Am's Monsoon sound system for tracking this station down. We were both convinced we were on the property where this transmitter was located, so I stopped the car and got out and opened the trunk. The car antenna is on the right rear of this car, so I reached in the trunk and unplugged the cable that comes from the radio where it meets the base of the antenna in the trunk. I then put my finger within an inch or two of the connector on the end of the coax, and behold, WHGT suddenly appeared on the car radio, where we once had nothing but static. We then switched to 800 kHz, WCHA's frequency, and performed the same test. They also came in loud and clear, but they should, because they are only a few hundred yards away from the church property. No other station came in while doing this test, so we absolutely knew only the most powerful or nearest stations would register on my car radio with no antenna hooked up. In other trips to the church during daylight hours, no outdoor antenna could be seen from most vantage points. I can then assume if there is no antenna on the back side of this Christian school, where there is no access by car, they must be running an indoor, talking house type of transmitter. Just for grins, we drove to Waynesboro and went by the WCBG transmitter site because there had been some speculation that WHGT might be on their tower, but no such luck. I'll keep an eye on the situation and report any changes as soon as I become aware of them, says Dave Normant via the National Radio Club. Now, in case you haven't realized it, the strange thing about this is that it is a fully licensed FCC station. In fact, it's listed with 5,000 watts day and 1,000 watts at night, according to the NRC AM log. So it's extremely strange that they're running such low power with no visible antenna. In fact, it is listed at 10,960 John Wayne Drive in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, which I guess is close to Chambersburg. Furthermore, it is the successor on 1590 to WCBG in Chambersburg, which, as you may recall a few years ago, had to go off the air because the city stupidly put up a water tower too close to their existing transmitter site. Well, I guess the new station, WHGT, with no visible antenna, will not have problems like that. Here are excerpts from a long commentary, which appeared in DX Listening Digest 6050, by Wesley Anne Marie Dymoke, that's D-Y-M-O-K-E, who's executive director of Providence Community Radio. National Public Radio gets special treatment because of their political carriage, their vast ranks of loyal listeners who will mobilize on their defense if NPR suggests that they're under some kind of threat, just as they do every time someone in Congress threatens to reduce or eliminate the tiny federal proportion of their funding. NPR listeners, including myself, consider it a vital resource that should be preserved. Unlike most of their listeners, however, I don't consider them sacrosanct, and I've had some awful battles against the national office both at the FCC and in Congress. NPR gets kudos for keeping their listeners informed with balanced news on everything, except apparently NPR itself. NPR did not present a fair and balanced account of the low-power FM debate, and in fact went out of their way to shut us down using tactics that I would have years ago assumed beneath them. And you can bet I will never make that assumption again. And in my native Connecticut, NPR tried to seize control of a station that is far better than anything that they themselves have the courage to pursue. So let's say I enjoy the programming and producers, but there's not a lot of love lost between me and the national office. I shook hands with Kevin Close once and thought that he was one of the chilliest people I've ever met in my life, a shrewd, savvy, cold warrior who cut his teeth on VOA before coming to NPR, paranoid, resourceful, and ruthless. He serves NPR's interests well, but not their soul. In the old days, so-called public radio did not belong exclusively to NPR, and it still doesn't. There are plenty of non-NPR-affiliated public radio stations. But NPR worked hard to make it so that public radio became synonymous in the public mind with NPR, which is how we got to public radio now. No strict definition for this term exists, legally or otherwise, but generally, public radio is any radio that is funded by, in any significant degree, by money that comes from the public, either through direct donorship, the primary channel for what I'll call small-letter public radio, or publicly managed funding, such as NPR's receipt of monies from Congress. Now, it's worth pointing out that the disparity of public funding in comparative proportion is very great between small-letter and big-letter public radio. A station like WPKN, Bridgeport, Connecticut, gets 100% of its funding through direct listener contributions. In fact, their bylaws disallow them from accepting corporate underwriting or any other non-listener funding. By comparison, although the exact amount varies from one fiscal or congressional cycle to another, NPR receives only about 4% of its funding from Congress. After that, the breakdown varies from one affiliate to another, as each is, at least on paper, a wholly independent entity. But the information I've gotten suggests a rough average of around 30% funding for each station from direct listener donations. The rest, which you've noticed is the bulk of the budget, comes from underwriting, both local and national. Of course, NPR's entire system depends on their apparent poverty, so that even with a massive deathbed endowment from McDonald's founder Ray Kroc's widow, they still do their regular begathons. This is extremely important because they have to establish and nurture a direct relationship with their listeners, or they lose the mystique of public radio and come under scrutiny from their listeners, who also provide their only political clout. NPR's issue with low power and pretty much everyone else in public radio is that they don't want to share. By this time, NPR has become an enormous and very shrewd corporation, and they don't want any competition, especially in the restricted bands, which they consider their own territory. They've used every tactic they can come up with to drive the rest of us out. It was NPR who convinced the FCC to sunset Class D, the original low-power FM. It was NPR who took advantage of the national chill in public radio in the wake of the 1978 Pacifica case and convinced colleges and universities to hand over management of their public radio stations to NPR affiliate corporations, most of them run entirely by staff who are paid directly by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In theory, the FCC decides each translator dispute on a question of public service, and in this realm, NPR usually wins out over others. In respect to religious translators, if we set aside for a moment the elephant in the room, NPR, we're looking at two or three different sorts of groups. There are a handful of gigantic God-casting groups who dominate translator service in some areas, even threatening NPR's hegemony in some places, but either way pose an insurmountable challenge to small-time broadcasters of all sorts. The major incumbent groups, NPR, Minnesota Public Radio, and the giant Godcasters, must be forced to share in the interests of meeting the Commission's statutory obligation to promote diversity, while the FCC is not allowed to see the difference between one broadcaster and another in terms of specific content. They can still see that one owner is different from another in name and should work harder to see more names in their list of allocation owners. However, this might result in major Godcasting taking the same strategy as NPR, and instead of owning lots of stations, simply affiliate large networks of ostensibly independent entities over large areas. This would be an end run around the conglomeration issue. But if nothing else, it would probably mitigate or eliminate the high-ticket wheeling and dealing that seems to be going on within the really big broadcast groups by reducing their size and reach and turning over large numbers of their assets to smaller entities. That was by Wesley Anne Marie Dymoke of Providence Community Radio. You're listening to Continent of Media 0603. Our address, WORADIO at yahoo.com, or P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA. Much more via our website, worldofradio.com. Meanwhile, north of the border, there is more diversity coming on the dial. Artie Bigley sends a story from CJNews.com by Janice Arnold. The Canadian Radio and Telecommunications Commission okays a Jewish AM radio station for Montreal. All Jewish, all the time, in fact, is their slogan already on the Internet. It's called Radio Shalom, spelled with an S if you speak English, or with a C if you speak French. It's been given permission to operate a commercial religious station in French, 60%, English, 30%, and Hebrew, 10%, at 1650 kilohertz with 1,000 watts, to be heard in Greater Montreal and possibly a little further at night. Although it's commercial, it's not for profit. It relies largely on volunteers. It's been on the air since 1999 via a subcarrier on CIRA 91.3 FM, which is a religious station owned by Radio Ville-Marie. And for a couple of years, Radio Shalom has been heard on the Internet. Their first application for an AM spot was turned down by the CRTC 3 years ago. Program director Philippe Regnault says he expects the station to be on the air by the end of May or early June. Believed to be the only Jewish radio station of its kind, not just in Canada, but in the entire Western Hemisphere. Well, I think that's probably an exaggeration depending on how you define of its kind. The article continues, before receiving its license, Radio Shalom must receive a go-ahead from the Department of Industry that it has met all technical requirements. But this is a formality. The license will be valid until the end of August 2012. Although it is designated a religious station, much of its content will more accurately be described as cultural or ethnic in nature. Coordinator of English programming Stan Asher says this is not just going to be rabbis praying and gloomy news about Israel. There will be talk shows, phone-ins, interviews, music, and hourly news. It'll sound like a regular radio station, not some propaganda machine. Most of the content will be local, live programming. The station has taken the decision to respect Shabbat and Jewish holidays by airing no programming at that time. That dead air has enabled Radio Shalom to comply with one of the CRTC's conditions, that it provide balance in its religious programming. For 18 hours each week from Friday night to Saturday night, Radio Shalom will make its airways available to other religious and ethnic communities, which do not now have access to radio elsewhere. And 15% of the weekly airtime is to be devoted to programs produced by other religious groups. The groups cited in the decision are the Communauté Catholique Congolaise de Montréal, the Association Socioculturelle Bulgare. Other programs to be broadcast include La Religion au Québec, a review of religious matters, and Sanatan Dharma, which deals with Hinduism. From faraway Valley Village, California, on the ABDX list, Brian Layton comments on this. It seems like it will be a money pit. Despite the size of the Jewish community of Montreal, I just can't see how they'll be able to put together the kind of programming they're talking about and pull in enough of an audience to make it pay for itself. The problem with appealing to the Jewish community is that we generally listen to the same thing everyone else does. Most Jews aren't that interested in strictly Jewish programming. The only exception would be the Orthodox population, and even there you're probably talking about only the ultra-Orthodox who won't listen to regular music stations. That's way too small a population to be worthwhile. Finally, Sheldon Harvey of CIDX in Montreal says, here's the webpage link for more information if you'd like to find out what to expect. It's been running online for quite some time. Check the program lineup at www.radio-shalom.ca. And keep an ear on 1650, where it's supposed to appear sometime this summer. On the ABDX list, here is a commentary by Scott Feibusch about so-called high-definition radio. My hunch is we're going to end up learning three things as a result. One, fewer AM stations will go HD than we all think. I know of several big AM groups that have already said, more or less publicly, that they're not interested in adding HD, period. There are other groups that have more quietly made the decision to try HD on FM, where they at least have the promise that multicasting holds, but not to bother on AM. And of course, there are thousands upon thousands of small AMs, not just the classic mom-and-pop stations, but all the ones owned by small groups, too, that will not bother. Out of 4,500 AM stations, I'd be surprised if more than 500 or so ever go HD. Two, most of the AM stations that go HD will cause few real-world problems as a result. For most of the stations on regional or graveyard channels, the additional adjacent channel skywave from nighttime HD operation will be just a minimal addition to the already substantial noise levels on the band. Three, but, and this is the big one, of course, for the relatively small number of stations on the clear channels, I think night HD will have a measurable impact. My friend Bob Savage, who owns WYSL 1040, just south of Rochester, New York, will certainly lose nighttime coverage, even within his relatively small protected contour. He's only 500 watts at night, if WBZ goes 24/7 HD. WBZ 1030 in Boston itself will lose coverage from KDKA 1020 in Pittsburgh and WHO 1040 Des Moines. And of course, if Bob were to add HD, he has no plan to, it would wipe out WBZ here in Rochester, which is well within BZ's own protected skywave contour. There will be high-profile cases and maybe even lawsuits. I don't know how it will play out, but I'm inclined to agree if this is what the big boys in the business really think they want, let's let them try it. Here's another opinion on the so-called high-definition radio, or AM-IBOC topic, from Harry Helms in Texas on the ABDX list. For reception of analog AM at night, widespread adoption of AM-IBOC will make an already noisy band sound like absolute hell. I can't see how it could have anything but a negative impact on the protected areas of many existing broadcasters, with lawsuits to follow. Adjacent channel interference will go up by a significant degree, and the real losers will be ordinary listeners, not DXers. For example, if WOAI 1200 San Antonio goes to night IBOC operation, I guarantee you that Metroplex listeners to 1190 and Rio Grande Valley listeners to 1210 will notice some interference, and the coverage of those two stations in their target markets will be impacted. And affected listeners will not file complaints with the FCC. They'll just get tired of that interference and tune away. Stations going IBOC will also find their coverage area reduced by interference from other stations' IBOC sidebands. We've already seen how the few existing AM IBOC receivers, like the now legendary BA receptor, seem to need a pristine AM IBOC signal for successful demodulation. It'll be interesting to see what happens when they try to sort out multiple AM IBOC sidebands. One of the best ways to screw someone over is to give them exactly what they say they want, and night IBOC operation on AM is an example of that. I suspect the net impact on night AM IBOC will be to drive even more listeners away from the AM band to FM and satellite, etc. Rather than being the answer to the dropping AM radio audiences, I feel nighttime IBOC will only exacerbate that trend. And you know I wouldn't lie to you because you're all my friends, says Harry Helms, W5HLH. Finally, part of a commentary from the Public Diplomacy Council. Is the U.S. about to silence its own radio voice in English? Incredibly, it is. Unless Congress or the administration reverse course, in most of the world, the English service of the Voice of America will be off the air forever this October. The sole survivor would be a few hours of Africa-focused news in English. This is truly unthinkable in the view of many inside and outside of government, because English is the universal language of international politics, trade, entertainment, and the Internet, spoken by more than a billion people. It is the primary tongue of the world's only superpower and largest predominantly English-speaking country, and the language of choice for new around-the-clock services of Al Jazeera, Russia, and China, as even Iran ramps up its English broadcast to the world. At a recent panel of the Davos World Economic Forum in Switzerland, the presidents of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Queen of Jordan engaged in a discussion about change and challenge in each of their countries. To no one's surprise, the leaders of four countries, pivotal in the anti-terrorism struggle of ideas, were conversing in English. The Broadcasting Board of Governors that oversees VOA and other U.S. international broadcasters says this decision to virtually abolish English and eliminate entirely five other voice languages, Turkish, Thai, Georgian, Greek, and Croatian, is painful but essential. The board maintains that resources should be redirected toward Arab and predominantly Muslim countries to fight the war on terror, and that shortwave is used by fewer and fewer people in a digital age. Further, specialists in public diplomacy can hardly believe that cutting off VOA radio and TV in Turkey is consistent with the goal of winning the war on terror, despite expansions in Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and the Afghan languages. Turkey is a vital strategic bridge between the Islamic world and Europe, essential to support stability in Iraq if that nation descends into a sectarian civil war. The planned disappearance of English to China is equally baffling. There are more people studying English in China than there are speakers of English in all of North America. Today, VOA is the only U.S. publicly funded overseas network broadcast in English and our only unjammed American broadcast to the world's most populous nation. But aside from simplified special English transmissions to the PRC, VOA's present 9 hours daily of English to China will disappear next year unless wiser heads prevail. We are convinced that it is a strategic imperative to preserve the radio base for all these transmissions, English and the foreign languages, if VOA is to continue to serve the nation as it has so well for the past 64 years. But as VOA reallocates talent and resources to different audiences, TV and Internet, to keep pace with changes in global media habits, it must retain a central informational news and current affairs core based on the highest standards of accuracy and objectivity and reflecting, as they always have, our country in its noisy and cantankerous diversity. A reallocated or supplemental funding of some $23 million would maintain VOA worldwide English to all areas and make its strategic languages viable, including the threatened Russian and Turkish. That's only about 3% of the entire international broadcasting budget request for fiscal 07, and it would make the voice whole and hail once again. Let our voice continue to be heard. So says the Public Diplomacy Council. With a standard disclaimer, Glenn Hauser concluding, Continent of Media, 0603, also known as World of Radio Extra 66.